Hey, I'm Andy Parker. This is the UX Coach Podcast. I believe that by sharing our experiences, we can redefine how we learn and find purpose in work by helping each other grow. I started this podcast to share people's stories about how they've developed their skills within the UX industry, where the future is heading, and what makes a great UX practitioner. Want to share your story and your experiences with everyone else in the industry? Get in touch with me at theuxcoach.com. Let's get into the episode. This time around, I'm speaking to Tom Bird. Tom and I met a few years ago, and this is actually the second time I've interviewed him for the show. We first tried this the week before the UK closed its borders and shut the country down for COVID. After some time away, I wanted to revisit the topics of design education and see how Tom's feelings on boot camps for UX had changed, if at all, and to hear Tom share what it was like to join a company the week before the world caught fire, the impact that had on his employee experience, and his recent move into a product design role for a fully remote-first company. Here we go.
My name's Tom Bird. I'm currently a senior product designer at a healthcare scale-up in London. I'm leading a small team of four designers, product designers, in our end-to-end UXD activities in the company. So a company I'm working for is called Patchwork. Been there just under a year now. Absolutely loving it. In previous roles, I've worked in various different size companies, from early-stage startups of teams of about 20 to 30, all the way up to kind of national brands, that are, you know, talking like billions of dollars turnover sort of thing. The roles that I've been in have ranged from full end-to-end user-centered product design, where you're looking at kind of research and discovery, problem definition, designing, testing, prototyping, all that jazz, as well as more kind of specialized roles where the teams have been bigger. My last role, for example, was a purely UX role, and on the research and a much more conceptual level.
You started in like traditional graphic design, didn't you?
Yeah, so my journey started at university. I actually went to one of the worst ranked universities in the country as it goes, and I got a degree in graphic design. I like to think I turned that around and did okay out of it, but I'll let you be the judge. So I started off as traditional design. So I think my first job was in print design, working in higher education. So designing like brochures, physical materials, prospectuses, banners, exhibition material, and that sort of thing. And then I kind of quickly realised that probably wasn't the future, and that, you know, web and digital is the way forward, and there's a lot more. Personally, what I think is a lot more interesting projects to work on. And so I kind of moved into web design after that.
You've changed jobs amidst the world being on fire, which is kind of crazy when we think of that we're having this conversation almost 3 years later. But the first time we spoke was the week before our government in the UK announced that they were going to close the borders. And we were sat around my kitchen table where you were feeling a little bit rough and a little bit sniffly. And the tables have turned now because I've definitely got like late onset summer hay fever. What's that been like moving from a company in a very transitionary period, just for like the ways of working? What's changed?
Yeah, so I've actually changed jobs twice since the first lockdown. I don't know whether that was a smart move or not, but it's just how it turned out. I think when I applied for the role, things were just starting to unravel with COVID, and my expectation was to work full-time in the office in London. In the time that it took me to hand my notice in and start that new role, I think the first lockdown happened. So I actually started a new role during peak lockdown, and I don't think many companies were prepared for that because the onboarding experience was a bit choppy. It took a while to kind of get to know everyone, understand exactly, you know, where my remit was, who the right people to contact were, understanding ways of working remotely. I think that was quite an interesting thing that I had to adapt to. Mm. I think I was working remotely for that company for about a year before people started going back into the office. But what I found was where I had started remotely, I hadn't sort of experienced their culture or their social side of the company. Uh-huh. So as a result of that, when I went back into the office, I felt a bit like a bit of an outsider because I didn't really know anyone on a personal level. Because the only time I'd spoken to people was over a video call or, you know, meetings where there wasn't actually that much time for small talk, and it's not quite the same as being in a room with someone. It felt like I was looking at a new guy again, even though I'd been there a year, which is really strange.
How has that changed, if at all?
Yeah, so the role that I'm in at the moment, it's a remote first setup. So essentially it's work from home unless you want to come in the office. There's no pressure to come in a set number of days a week or a set number of days a month. Where we're kind of growing quite fast, and we've just secured a new round of funding recently, the team is just massively growing at a rapid pace. So every time I go in the office, I feel like there's a new person there. So I feel like if I wasn't going in the office on a regular basis, on that kind of weekly basis, there'd be a whole load of people, like internal stakeholders, wider teams, I wouldn't actually have that much face time with, that I'm actually kind of getting to know now. Which is really nice. And as a result of that, I don't feel like I'm excluded from any of this kind of social side of things. Even though it's only once a week, the whole sort of exposure to people, you know, actually in person rather than video call, it makes a huge difference.
Mm.
100%.
With that company being, as you said, remote first, did that mean that some of those onboarding processes were a bit better and made you feel a little bit more connected with what was going on?
Yeah, so this was completely different, and it was completely refreshing in contrast to the role previous to that. Before I'd even started, my line manager reached out to me to make sure there was anything that I needed for my first day, set up my home office way before I actually started. And I think in my first day, I already had about 2 weeks worth of introduction calls scheduled in my diary. The onboarding experience was completely different. It was like night and day.
What's it been like with taking responsibility of people's development and supporting in that area? So you've got a few people that you work with in this role. I think when we originally met, were you the designer of one for that team?
To start with, yes. I think when we spoke, I was making my first hire for a junior.
That's right, yeah.
Junior to midweight. But that role was predominantly in the office, so it was a little bit different. So working remotely and trying to nurture a team, you know, 90% of the time remote is completely different, and you do have to think of more creative ways to actually go about that. I think the hardest thing is trying to build up a design culture remotely. That's something I'm still trying to figure out how to go about doing effectively. And I think quite a lot of people in the industry are trying that as well. It's a struggle I've seen across the board, that a remote culture is a much more difficult thing to build than if you was in the office, because you don't have those, you know, you don't have those water cooler conversations. You don't have the small talk in the corridors, you know, that sort of thing. It's a lot more difficult to get people excited to do team bond activities and that sort of thing. A key part of it is just having more regular lines of communication than you would if you was in an office. So regularly checking in from a sort of personal and well-being point of view, as well as a professional point of view. You know, I think it's quite easy to accidentally micromanage when you're remote as well. So just being wary of that, and making sure you're not being too in the detail, and that you trust your team to get the work done. And you hire them for a reason, you know. You shouldn't be kind of like worrying whether they're getting to work and that type of thing.
That's one of the hardest things to overcome, I think, is with trust. With that, ultimately comes respect as well. And there seems to be an element with certain organisations that's been sort of lost. There is absolutely no trust in the workforce from leadership teams, which kind of seems crazy, because we're all adults, so why would you hire people if you're not going to respect them and trust them for being who they are?
Yeah.
Another aspect of it, which is this hybrid model that you're going through and you've experienced as well from two different sort of angles, and being new and coming into an environment where everyone previously got together, and as the debate has raged on for the last few years of the concept of back to normal, failing to acknowledge and accept that this is the new normal. There is no such thing as going back to normal.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
That ability to adapt to that, how would you approach that yourself? That experience that you had of feeling like an outsider, even though you'd been there for a while, and that returning to a physical location or the need to at all?
That's a good question. The funny thing is, when I accepted that role, I was fully expecting to be in the office full time. But then I got the taste of the remote working side of things. You know, commuting from Brighton to London every day, it's expensive. So when someone says, you know, you have to come back to the office 3 or 4 days a week, there's a financial side of it. And I know that's very much my problem, but I've been working remotely for, say, like a year, and now I'm being asked to kind of spend £400 or £500 a month to commute to the office. It's an easy decision for me personally, unless I haven't been effectively able to do my job remotely. I think I agree with what you said. You have to sort of accept that new normal. I fully agree that there are certain things that are done better when working face-to-face. I'm not a massive fan of remote workshops. I don't find them particularly productive compared to, you know, everyone sitting in a room, and I find it a lot more collaborative having people to kind of interact with face-to-face. So any time in my team that we have a workshop or a sort of brainstorming session, I will try and encourage in the office. But where we're a distributed team, we're coming from, it's a case of giving enough notice, having the flexibility to say, you know, you don't have to turn up at 9 o'clock, you know, that sort of thing. There's a huge element of flexible working that needs to be involved. So working remotely, you don't need to be working 9 to 5 at your desk to be productive. I'm a big believer of output rather than hours worked. Going back to the trust thing, if you can get your work done, your day's work done that you've agreed to do in, I don't know, 4 hours, that's fine. I don't care what you do for the rest of the day. It's up to you. But if you agree to do a certain amount of work, and then that becomes an issue because you're not putting in the hours or putting in the kind of productivity, I think that's when it becomes an issue.
I think there's so many cultural things that are radically changing with the work mindset, right, as a result of this. And that's what's becoming difficult for particularly large organisations to be able to understand and quantify, because it's not just a case of the desk that you sit at. There's a load of other things that go with it that mean that the way of working significantly has to change for that to work. Something else that I think I've observed, I'm really keen to know whether you've seen similar things, particularly where you've got younger members of the team, is that whilst there are many people who will say, oh, I never want to work in an office again, that's because they've got the space to be able to not do that. That's not the situation for everybody. And there's still a lot of any company that's got young employees will have people living in house shares, still living at home, where that's just not possible. Have you seen the same kind of things?
Yeah. I mean, quite a few people on my broader team, they are in that situation where they're living in London, living in a house share because, you know, it's the only affordable way of living in London and staying there. Their productivity definitely is affected when they're at home, and they've openly admitted that. I think it's a lot easier where you're a hybrid model and you do have the options to go into the office as much or little as you want. So, for example, if I was in London living in a house share, I'd probably go in the office 3 or 4 times a week. I think it's all about allowing your employees to make that decision themselves and make that distinction themselves, not dictating that you have to be in the office 3 days a week.
Let's talk about your deeper background and just that progression that you've had through design education and moving through. So you did formal study and then moved into web design. You've done a little bit of formal education and private-based education as well, right?
Yeah, so I think the transition between graphic design and web design was somewhat natural. I think quite a lot of people do that. But once I'd done a couple of years in digital design, I started having recruiters approach me with these new types of roles, and they said things like UX and product design and stuff like that. I was like, oh, that looks fancy. And I was looking through like job descriptions and stuff, and I'm sure a lot of people have done this. They'd be like, I feel 50-60% of the job description, I'll chuck in an application thinking that, you know, I do UX, but yeah, you quickly realize that you do not. So I think the turning point was I had an interview for a UX position. Don't know how I got an interview because my portfolio and CV was absolutely no way tailored to a CV of a UX designer or product designer. And I just remember it being the most humiliating experience I've ever had professionally, because I was presenting in this interview thinking that, oh yeah, I'm a UX designer, but he was asking that they were asking questions that I had absolutely no idea the answer to, and I must have said I honestly don't know so many times, and tried to kind of like coast through it. I came out of that interview completely humiliated because I shouldn't have been in there, you know. And as a result of that, I started looking at deeper into, you know, what is UX, what is user research, what is usability testing, and all these different things. Because as a web designer, I was doing the visual side of it, and there's a certain element of discovery with web design, but nowhere near the amount that you'd be doing as a UX designer. So I started speaking to a few recruiters, and obviously they told me that, yeah, you're not a UX designer. You've got a lot of work to get to that position, even at a junior level. I was like, a bit taken aback when I heard that. And they mentioned that many people getting into those entry-level roles are coming out of like Flatiron School and General Assembly and places like that. And I had no idea what that was. I'd never heard of it before. So, you know, I kept looking into things, and the rabbit hole got bigger and bigger and bigger. And I came across General Assembly as a result of that. It's a short-term bootcamp style of education aimed to upskill people into UX design. As a result of that, I enrolled into a part-time bootcamp from General Assembly to do with UX. And it's probably worth noting that my experience will probably be vastly different to someone the full-time course in comparison. So firstly, the reason I did part-time was, coming from a visual design background, I was fairly knowledgeable in that area. So I was looking to mainly pick up things about like user research, UX design, information architecture, and all the methodologies that go along with it. So I was traveling up to London to the General Assembly hub. I think it was twice a week in the evenings. So I was doing 3 or 4 hours twice a week in the evening for 3 months. And in that time, you know, they kind of teach you certain things and the basics of UX design. And you come out, you know, with an accreditation saying you went to General Assembly, and you know, whatever that's worth now, I don't really know. But
because it's focused on like fundamentals, isn't it?
Yes.
Of the it's really very much that 101. The difference with the full time one is that it's like going back to school, right? So it's Monday to Friday, it's full time every single day. But key hook is with the full time course, you get put onto actual client projects, like real live projects, right? Does that happen with the part-time one as well?
So there is a certain sort of introductory part of it at the end of it, so you do get introduced to potentially work on those projects, but it's a lot more open to that full-time course. In terms of like the education that they give, I think it's fairly similar, but the key thing that you get from a full-time one is you get 3 case studies to put in your portfolio, whereas a part-time one you only have time for one. But I don't think the curriculum or the material they're delivering is much different, as far as I'm aware.
I think it's pretty much the same, right? But it's got more time to explore each component.
Yeah, and going back to what you mentioned about it being the fundamentals of UX design, I think that's an incredibly important point, because myself included, a lot of people go into these courses thinking they're going to be learning everything there is to know about UX design.
What do you think were the benefits that you got from doing that? What did you gain those missing foundations that you were looking for originally?
Yeah, so I'm quite a sort of detail-orientated person, I like to think. So where I was learning stuff in class, I had the sort of diligence to go away and research those things in a lot more detail and kind of pick up more and more information. And I think that's a key part of it. As long as you're sort of thinking critically, you have that kind of critical thinking to know that there is a lot more to learn outside of the basics that you're learning, that does massively help. I think there's a certain amount that you learn on the job that they can't teach you in a bootcamp environment. So, for example, how like business works and working with stakeholders and a lot more of the soft skills, so like resilience and that type of thing. But I found personally that I've developed like exponentially after the bootcamp than I did when I was within it. And I would say that the whole Dunning-Kruger effect thing is so true. That I came out of that bootcamp, and I'll be completely transparent and say that I thought I knew it all. And I thought that like I was ready to be a UX designer, to the point where I probably burnt a bridge or two because of it. Because that role that I went into straight after my bootcamp, I went in with the mentality that, you know, there's this process you have to follow. You have to do things this way, X, Y, Z. You have to do the research. You have to do the problem definition. You have to put together a journey map, you have to do an empathy map, you have to storyboard, you have to do paper prototype. When in fact, you know, that's quite a lot of work, and majority of the projects, you don't need to go into that much detail unless it's a huge sort of abstract problem you're trying to solve. I mean, a lot of the time you're just doing incremental changes that you just need to kind of test and make sure it makes sense. So I'd say there's a huge, huge amount that you learn on the job that you just can't pick up in 3 months.
So you've had this fairly immersive experience and learning on the job, which I think is really where we all do the majority of our education when it comes to our careers. And now you find yourself in this product role. What are the key differences between being a UX designer and a product designer or a product manager or product owner or whichever one of the various different titles that kind of form out of that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you'll agree that the industry itself can't define what that is. But, I mean, the key difference is your sort of remit and responsibility that I've experienced. So when I was a UX designer, I was working in a much bigger team, and you had individual roles for UI design, UX design. We had a user researcher that floated around the different teams, and essentially it was just focusing on a smaller part of the end-to-end journey. Whereas as a product designer, it's a lot more diluted, I found. So although you still have the opportunity to do that research, I found that you just don't have as much time. And again, it depends on the company. Some companies have a lot higher UX maturity levels than others. And it depends how much buy-in you've got to do that type of stuff, isn't it? Mm. So I think a lot of people see product designers, or there's a misconception that product designers are just UI designers who have an appreciation of UX. Whereas I see it as, you know, you have exposure to the whole end-to-end process of research, design, testing, and you know, kind of hand off to engineers.
Yeah,
it's the kind of thing I've noticed. The definition of a product designer does vary completely depending on what company you're in.
Yeah.
So some companies I've seen, for example, it is purely just a UI designer, but they see product designer as a sort of like trendy title.
If someone is coming out of university at the moment, or they're in that transitionary phase of wanting to move careers, and they're looking at how they can get that fundamental learning experience first and foremost, what would your advice to them be?
So if I was coming out of university myself now, you may not be aware of this, but like I would do something like a combination of something like the Google UX certification combined with working with a mentor. I think that UX course, it's on Coursera, and you can pay for a monthly subscription, which is quite low. I think it's about £30 a month, but that goes into a lot more detail than I did in my part-time course in General Assembly, and you learn a lot more than I learned. The only issue is you have to take everything with a pinch of salt there, because the work that you're doing is graded by peers and other people doing the course, which again doesn't make sense, but you're still going to have an opportunity to learn that stuff, which is why I'd recommend getting a mentor as well. So working alongside someone that's actually experiencing what you're learning, and just kind of ensuring that you're digesting that content correctly and you're understanding it right, because otherwise I think you could quite quickly come unstuck if you do manage to find a role off the back of that.
With that natural progression, then you're learning something because you have a goal to be doing that every day. What about the same aspect for that job, like hunting experience? What's your advice for people there?
Going back to the Google course again, the issue with that is it's churning out hundreds of thousands of graduates a month. And there just isn't an abundance of junior positions. I mean, there are some out there, but you have to kind of work a bit harder to find them. I think with junior positions, they're not typically advertised like other roles are. It's all about kind of networking, getting yourself out there, going to meetups as much as possible. And then looking at it from a more, I guess, long-term point of view, because I think it is extremely difficult to get into a UX role as your first job. What I would recommend is looking at it as a how can you get your foot in the door sort of thing. So whether that's if you come, like myself, come from a visual design background, trying to get a UI position first, where you do have access to UX designers and product designers, and then just be proactive about volunteering to kind of help out and assist with the kind of testing sessions, or being a note taker, or being an observer role in the stuff they're doing. And then you're getting exposure to the stuff that you want to be doing. Or the alternative is looking for companies with that lower maturity level, I think, perhaps, because I don't understand what UX designer is. But once you're in that role, you can try and influence your position to kind of start doing these things that UX designer does, and having the platform to do that type of thing. But I'd say the better way is looking at it from a sideways point of view, getting into a role where you have exposure to those type of roles, where you can get a little bit of experience here and there and build up your sort of knowledge and exposure to it, like piece by piece. But I think, again, a junior UX role is crazy right now, and I don't know if there's a better way to go about it, if I'm honest.
I think there's an incredibly saturated market at the moment, and that's just because we've lost so many businesses over the last couple of years as well. Also, it's a challenge for the likes of us to be able to think about how do we start developing our own internal capabilities to bring people on at that graduate level, and think about how you teach people on the job, right?
Yeah, and just one last point. I think there is a from my experience, there's a misunderstanding of kind of levels anyway. So a lot of people say, "Oh, you're not a midweight until you've done 3 years experience." But like I said, if you've done 3 years experience in a shitty company where they don't know what UX is, that's completely different to someone that's done 3 years in 3 different companies a year each. Mm. So there is a certain level of understanding, your having a self-awareness of, you know, where are you in your journey. I don't buy into the whole fake until you make it mentality. I mean, it's something I sort of like thought about previously, and I very quickly got found out, and it's not something I'd recommend. But I think there is an awareness of, when you are hiring for positions, especially not just looking for a year's experience, you need to look at that, the kind of work that they've done and the experiences that they've had.
Yeah, what they've been doing in that experience.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
Yeah, yeah, very true.
Right, just do a shameless plug before we go. I am actually hiring myself a product designer in the next couple of weeks or month. So I'd be really interested if anyone wants to reach out and kind of have a chat about that.
Where do they go?
You can find me on LinkedIn. So I'm not sure what my handle is on LinkedIn. I don't think I've actually changed it from the default. But if you search for Tom Bird Patchwork, I should pop up with a nice cheesy looking grin. Or you can email me at hello@thomas-bird.com.
There we go. Another episode done. As always, if you would like to share your story with the design industry and the rest of the world, then get in touch with me. Go to theuxcoach.com. and have a look at the podcast section. All the information is there. Get in touch. I would like to hear your story. So would everybody else. Until next time, I've been Andy Parker. Look after yourself.